Steve Dadashinsky, hi.
How are you?
Fine, you?
I'm doing okay. You know, I like a little sunshine, but that's what happens in Paris in October.
Yeah. So I wanted to meet you because you write poetry while listening to jazz concerts mainly. And you also do performances that we may call spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
You say your poems with musicians going with you.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question would be, do you think of yourself as a poet or as a musician?
Well, first, I don't consider what I do spoken word.
Okay.
Although I speak it, it's first written, so I would... I once referred to it as written word spoken.
All right.
And within that context, when I do read with musicians, which is quite often, I sometimes improvise within the text. I don't like to call myself a poet, but I guess that's what I do.
Why is that? Why don't you like?
It's a big word. It's a label. It carries a responsibility. And I don't know if I'm responsible enough to carry that responsibility. As far as being a musician, I've been told by people after doing gigs with musicians that they felt I was a musician. And that happens more to me here in France than it does in America, but I certainly have a musical quality which shows itself more when I'm reading with musicians, although now I can kind of do it when I'm reading solo because I've gained these performative qualities that allow me to be freer even while I'm reading, because I'm a page poet. I don't memorize things. So that's also why I don't consider it what I do spoken word. Most people affiliated with the spoken word term are people who memorize who can do freestyle or so-called rap. And I can't do that. I can't memorize stuff. But I think more from the people who are hearing me than my own personal opinion is that I apparently have gained a large musicality in my vocabulary, and that it displays itself a lot when I'm reading, particularly with musicians. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my hearing, listened for it on the floor among the beer stains and sticky soles. I lost my seeing, groped around in the dark for it somewhere between the bar and the men's room. I lost my voice, so I now speak to you in messages. I lost my sense of smell. I lost my touch, so you must play for me soft and gentle. I lost my way, so you must guide me with your song. Kerouac rhymes with Pontiac. Recognition, art, politics, religion, even God has a desire to be recognized. Yesterday chases me back to the master's cunt. The stations along the way lead me to absolute knowledge. Absolute knowledge. The city is no longer half empty. The city is no longer half full. It is just a city. And it is my secret place. And I shall keep it in here forever.
when reading your poetry, it appears immediately that sound leads the way. Is that true?
I think that's become more of an evident truth, particularly with musicians, and if the gig is really going the way I like it. I sometimes have told by people, particularly my dear wife, that I read too fast sometimes, and sometimes that's because I'm nervous about the time constraint put on me, but also because if I'm with musicians, sometimes once I start going, it's a kind of rhythm that I don't like to stop. I like to think of it as a continuous soloing, and sometimes in the past couple of years, I've written poems that deal with artificial languages and sounds, because I get just bored sometimes reading words or...
What do you mean artificial?
Well, words I make up.
All right.
That don't exist. Sometimes they're in different languages, like based on German. I have one I finally typed recently from that I wrote about 3 years ago that has a lot of fake Czech words in it because I was in the Czech Republic for a week. But basically, it's basic English vocabulary, and I like to read it faster now for a lot of reasons, because, it makes the words feel more like sounds. And in like a poem I wrote in a book of mine of poems just for Cecil Taylor, there's... It's not that old, the poem, but it's one of what I think is a prime example of where I'm using real language and mixing it with invented language. And some of the invented language was as simple as taking the word and writing it backwards, because I get bored with my own limited vocabulary. So, you know, it's like musicians, although I don't think a lot of musicians would admit they have a limited vocabulary, but a lot of musicians and visual artists have limited vocabularies, and they have to continually think of new ways to reinvent the language, even if they're using the same five words over and over again.
I traveled to Giverny, to Giverny, to Giverny. I traveled to Giverny, to Giverny, to Giverny, to Giverny. To see what I can take back with me. To see what I can take back with me.
Do you have any other mean to reinvent yourself in your writing? Apart from making up words?
Well, like I've said many times before, I like to mix what's happening outside with what's happening inside, and making a kind of transformation of the two. And at the same time, although I'm a very linear thinker and I want to break away from that, so sometimes I'll deal with fragmentation. You know, to fragment the words or the lines, to change the space or the sound, the length. And a lot of times, I don't know that's going to happen until I'm reading the work. And, you know, I can read it, to me, what sounds the same every time, but is very possibly different because I'm not planning it. But, you know, there are a few poems that I read which is very specifically meant to read out loud. And I can vary a lot within the textures of the poems, or, you know, delete a line while I'm reading, or repeat a line, or maybe change the structure of the line while I'm doing it. So in that way, it's a lot like improvising, although I still rely on the page. So there have been times I've been put on the spot by musicians because I've been sitting in the audience and they said, come on up and read. And I say, I don't carry poems around in my pocket, which there was a period where I started doing that because I was thinking, that musician might ask me to come up again. But what they would usually say when I didn't have a poem is, just improvise. And I've done it maybe 3, 4, 5 times, but it's not really what I'm good at. I'm really bad at it, actually. You know, like I remember I once did it with John Chikai, and I got up and I didn't know what to do, and I was in the knitting factory, and I'm looking around the room, and I started saying, the red walls and the this and that, and there was something about happening politically, and I think I just threw it in, something about whoever was running for president or something like that. But, you know, I don't know if how much of my writing is accomplished or great or complete, but that kind of instantaneous stuff, it's probably my worst, my worst. You know, like I can improvise like this while we're talking, but somehow if you said, make up a poem on the spot, I could probably do it, but I want to be able to feel that free. I think that kind of freedom is really important for musicians and all artists in general to be able to feel that free. But for me, it's very difficult. But it does all involve sound, one way or the other. Everything involves sound.
But it also involves space in a way, don't you think? It's like when reading your poems, how they are on the page, how they appear on the page, seems to be as important as the sound they make. It made me think about a poet like T.S. Eliot, you know? Mm. So how does that work? Do you work them also on the space?
The spacing is very interesting. When you mention T.S. Eliot, I always think of, I was writing since I was very young, and my first connection to poetry that changed my way of writing was the Beat Generation. And then after that, as a teenager, I found E.E. Cummings, and the way he used the page and the space on the page became very important to me. But I still never thought about it as reading the work out loud. It was how it looked on the page. I don't know if T.S. Eliot spent a lot of time to figure it out. I didn't. I just said, good, T.S. Eliot does that, and I did that. And the other thing I learned from Eliot was not to capitalize, which is good because I'm a bad typist, and it's easier not to think about capitals or punctuation marks or any of that kind of stuff. But so it used to be important to me, and then what happened was... one time a magazine said to me, we love this poem, but it's too all over the page. If you give it to us, you know, left column, we'll use it. And I was still at a point of not wanting to compromise anything, but I said, okay, do it. So I did it. And I realized, it's not really affecting my language. It's not affecting the poem. They're not editing my words. So what I learned is I got more and more lazy. So a lot of the poems just became left side poems, short sentences or long sentences, but almost all left. And like this poem I was mentioned briefly that I wrote to be read out loud, which is called Vocalese. It has some stuff in it, and like there are separations with spaces, but it's basically written out like this, and that particular poem is all in capital letters, and it's about 5 pages, and I think it's in capital letters because I want everything in the poem completely emphasized all the time, and it was easier than making the choice of lowercase, and in this case, it's all capital, all in bold, and that gave me a new way of looking at and reading the poem, but... I think if I was very thoughtful about it, I would, like a musical score, really, you know, work it out. But I think also once you get into a comfortable groove when you're reading out loud, what it looks like even to me on the page as I'm reading it, isn't that important. But then again, what it looks to you reading it on the page, like the book you're holding, that could be a whole different thing. How you're hearing the poem and how I'm hearing the poem.
Well, about that, like sound relating to capitalization and punctuation, I kind of felt that the absence of punctuation, of capitalization, was a way of figuring the sound continuum that goes on and off and on and off from poem to poem, especially in the Charles Gales, in the Charles Gale book.
Oh yeah, I have a majority of the poems are like that because when I'm writing them on the spot, whether it's in a musical situation or looking at a painting or walking down the street, it is a continuum. It's one huge flow. And then sometimes when I type it up, I differentiate some of the lines with dashes or a space or a, not so much in poems, but more in liner notes, a little, whatever that little arrow is called. And yeah, this is all indication of space and breath. Now, sometimes there are deliberate stops, but most of those stops are thought about after it's written in a notebook and then finally typed up. It's very difficult to know while I'm writing it if it's a stop, if it's not a stop. And then sometimes I do take the reader into consideration more than the listener, like this might be too much if I just make it one big massive solo. Although there's an example in the Gale book when I was very bored called Intervals, where It just keeps going and going and going, and I played a game that I sometimes do in writing, but I decided to do it to the maximum, which is just like the poem says, how many words can I make from the how many words or whatever it is can I make from the word intervals? And while Charles was playing, my brain just kept dividing that word up and going and going and going and going and going, and until it eventually stopped. It probably stopped when the music stopped. A lot of poems I write to music either stop before the music or with the music. Sometimes in rare situations, although I can't quote you which situations because I've written so many poems in that situation, sometimes of course they'll go on after the music because maybe I'm in the middle of a thought and I don't really want to stop that thought. But a lot of them stop with the music. Some stop with the when I'm writing them on scrap paper. Some actually stop with the page, you know, and I'll come to some conclusion. There's two or three poems in there, one that I really love called Blackjack. It's one of the rare times I wanted to write a poem at the concert and was already anticipating writing the poem, but I started to write the poem before I got to the venue. And which was okay because stuff was happening around me, like my either real or imagined idea that there was this guy behind me saying blackjack, blackjack, blackjack. And where I say in the poem, lost page, I'm not sure whether I really lost a page or not, or I think I lost a page of the poem. And I still don't know to this day if it's complete, incomplete, or I lost the page. When I got to the venue in Brooklyn and finished the poem, I have this feeling pages dropped on the floor and one of them got lost. So the processes are all similar, but they're different. But the continual flow is very, very important.
So according to what you're saying, it seems that music is part of this world continuum that you're experiencing every day. So it's not really music that makes you write, is it?
I can only answer that by saying it's the circumstance that makes me write. In the case of that book, the big book you had, you know, Reaching into the Unknown, the book for Cecil, the book for Evan Parker, and a bunch of stray poems that have not been collected anywhere. I can honestly say, with the exception of the anticipation of the music in Blackjack, that all of those poems, for the most part, with the exception, say, in the Cecil book, the first poem was written when I was 19 years old, and it says, written after a Cecil Taylor concert. And there's a few pieces in this book that were not written at a live concert, but that were directly related to Charles. So I'd have to say that those particular books, those poems probably would not exist without the music. So it's a very tough question. But the music, of course, is in the continuum that we live in. So we all live in this, whether we like it or not, whether even I believe it or not, because I'm a very sometimes moving but stagnant person, as we all are. You know, the stabile and the mobile, you know, the whole idea of, you know, Alexander Calder, you know, you have the one that's like this and the one that's like that, and, you know. Stalactite and stalagmite. We're all up and down and we're all over the place, but we're all part of a continuum. So music is a big, for me, a very big part of that continuum.
Could it be music, but also the idea of music? The idea of music, the waiting for music, the memory of music?
Oh, 100%, but as much as I love music, I neither want to blame music or praise music that much that, you know, every minute when I'm doing something or writing a poem, music is there. Although I have to say, you know, I don't sleep very much. And one of the things that happens when I'm not sleeping is there's always a song going on in my head. It's what a young friend in New York termed, one of the terms from it called earworms, you know, that's like a broken record. And most of those songs are okay to mediocre rock and roll songs. It's not like I'm humming Naima all the time or something like that. And it's never improvised there, you know. A lot of them are really just silly rock and roll songs, you know. But I think that's more a neurotic residue of music rather than music we're talking about, which is a more, even more metaphysical than the actual physical idea of carrying music around with you and it being an integral part of your life. But yeah, it's an integral part of my life, and it's an integral part of pretty much everything. I mean, one of the biggest problems is, of course, this has to be a personal opinion, whether I think it's beyond my opinion or not, is that most of the music people carry around with them constantly in a physical and a metaphysical sense is not the music of the spheres. It's pretty shitty music, you know, and sadly that's what the majority of people listen to and want.
So about that, you mentioned Cecil Taylor, Evan Parker, we mentioned Charles Gayle. So why are these musicians inspiring you more than, say, I don't know, Wynton Marsalis? Why these musicians in particular?
Do I have to answer that question? Okay. I think Wynton Marsalis is a technically very good player. I mean, as are all these other people, you know. Let's just... Rather than even compare Wynton Marsalis to those guys, let's compare Wynton Marsalis to Lee Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, or my dear departed friend Roy Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe Wynton Marsalis has a great facility, but I just feel... It's like when I was a kid, people used to say to me, hey man, you know, you love jazz. You like Herbie Mann? And I would say, yeah, he's technically a very good player, but I'd rather listen to Eric Dolphy or Roland Kirk play the flute. Because I don't know if it's true or it's my imagination, but, you know, because Wynton Marsalis is certainly a popular musician who people would even say is a populist musician because he's so well loved and gets such big crowds. But I always feel there's something that's not happening down here. Evan is a super technically great musician, and sometimes, you know, the technique, and not just Evan, with a lot of people who are very into sound, the technique, which is a terrible word, can be more overpowering than the soul, because they're doing so many amazing things. But in Wynton Marsalis's case, it's technique that comes out as, you know, melody and phrasing, and there's really nothing adventurous happening. I mean, those people we mentioned, and I can mention more, I saw Michelle Doneda and Didier Lasserre last week. That was, I mean, the way I wrote about it, I kept writing about it and saying there are really no words to describe this. Why am I writing about this? Because they were, it was, if you want to use terrible language, it was like beyond mysterious and magical. And when Roscoe Mitchell played on Monday night, I mean, you know, I don't know how, where he is in his soul. It's hard to tell because he looks like he's really deep. But wherever he is, whether it's soul or technique or intellect or thought, like he's doing it. I shouldn't say whether, it's all of it together.
Thank you.
The intensity, the technicality, the abandonment, but at the same time the concentration, the places that he goes, that these other people I mentioned, Cecil Charles when he's at his best, they just go to places that very few people go. And Wynton Marsalis doesn't, I've heard one thing on record that I, of the little I've listened to Wynton Marsalis, where I thought he went somewhere, and oddly enough, it was a Monk tune. And I saw Wynton Marsalis live maybe 10 times in my life, and one time I really thought, in a small quartet he was in, that he was paralleling the great post-bop players I like Lee Morgan and you know, Clifford Brown and those guys. But most of those people are missing something. That's, and it's not because of the kind of music they play. It's because of, you know, I love post-bop music. You know, if you tell me, well, what makes you love Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers or Horace Silver? I don't know. It swings. It really swings and it goes somewhere. They're
having
fun.
So where do you go?
Where do I go?
Yeah.
I don't know, actually. I think unfortunately, I'm like I once said, I think I put it, I'm a very normal person trapped inside the body of a crazy person. But I would like to go more crazy, that's for sure. But I don't think I go far.
How would that be?
You mean with my work? Or with my brain?
I don't know, both.
Well, I'd like to be even more honest and open-minded than I am. I'd like to not ever hide any of my private language, and I'd like everybody to know exactly how I feel about everything, which is all not at all pleasant most of the time. As far as the music goes, I would like to, if I, talking about the music in my own poems, I would like to be able to be at a point where I can explode.
So for you, crazy is honest?
No. I'm talking about crazy in a freedom sense, where I would like to have the freedom to do whatever I can do within the limits of this box we are in. Meaning that I don't want to hurt anybody, really. I don't want to, you know, I would like whatever possible anger or angst that's in me, or to, since, you know, I think we all have a lot of negative space in us that we don't like to admit we have or that we're not aware of. I would like to utilize that within in the work more as well, to be freer with what I'm doing. And I think I'm starting to achieve that a little bit in the so-called performances I do. I would like to achieve it more in the writing as well, but it's very complicated for me to do it in the writing. But so being live when I'm doing it, that's where at this point the music and the poems interact more and collide, whether I'm reading with music or not. The music is, on that level, always presence within that continuum. Because I want to be able to feel as free as those people we talked about when they improvise. Even if sometimes it sounds like, wow, that's the same solo. Didn't I hear that before? But maybe it's like Roscoe on Monday night. I couldn't, would never say, wow, didn't I hear that before? It was all new. Everything he did was new. When he played at the Vision Festival in July, everything he did was new. I mean, I never, it's like the old ESP Records thing. I think that it went, you never heard such sounds in your life, something like, and that's what it was. And so the miracle to me is when you can walk away from something, whether it's your own work or someone else's work, and say, wow, I never heard that before. Or in the Cecil Taylor book, one of the first quotes I wrote in the book is, and it's not fair that I said the young man, but I said the young man speaks and has nothing to say. The old man says the same thing over and over again, but it's always new. So it's how you make it new. Not enough people make it new. Wynton Marsalis certainly doesn't make it new.
About your writing process, I'd like to know maybe a little more about how your work relates to music. How does it work? I mean, do you music inspires you, or you wrote that some of your poems respond to, reflect, or incorporate some of Charles Gale's music? How does that work?
Well, when I'm if it's a poem I'm writing while listening to the music, it's usually a direct or indirect response. The music triggers it. As I have said many times before, it's like if it's really happening, I'm collaborating with them. You know, they're playing as I'm writing, or I'm at whatever point I jump in with my solo, I start going. And like I said, sometimes I'll stop before it's over.
Are they aware of that?
No, unless I tell them.
All right.
Well, although there have been some rare times where a musician has said to me, once they got to know what I do, what was it you were writing? Were you writing a poem? But you know, I'm in the audience. They're up there doing what they're doing. I don't expect them to be aware of it. But yeah, it's always those things you just mentioned with everyone. And sometimes I could, you know, I'll go into the concert, the music will be the catalyst that starts me off. But like in this book, there's a poem about, I wrote after just coming from seeing an Andy Warhol film. There's a poem in there after coming from a Margaret Duras film, and they got incorporated into the poems. So the poems are not always completely immersed or about what's happening within the music or around the music. But the music at those moments, you know, is the catalyst, and how I work off it or with it or around it or even against it. Sure. I mean, like I said, all that huge body, which were a few hundred poems, I don't know how many there are, they're all because of the music. But, you know, there are many other influences outside the music, so.
Yeah, like what?
Well, I've written hundreds of poems looking at visual art, paintings particularly. I've written a small amount of poems over the years that were inspired by films. I have one little book that most of the poems in it were inspired by this series of Godard films I saw. But I mean, probably, other than just poems I've written that could be inspired from walking down the street, the largest body of poems inspired by some art form would be the music ones, because they were very constant, particularly from the 80s.
So you write a lot. How do you make a living?
Well, I don't make a living. So
You don't?
No. You mean, do I make a living from writing?
I don't. Well, and or from anything else?
Well, let's say, without going to all the details, I'm a retired gentleman now.
What's that?
Well, I'm old. I don't have to make a living. Yuko and I are very fortunate to be living in an apartment where, even though it's way too small, I live in a rent-stabilized apartment, which means my rent is very cheap. I've worked a lot of years, and I have enough. And we're not talking about a lot of money. I'm talking about I can survive with, you know, doing readings every now and then, and you know, not being a frivolous consumer and spending on things. Like, you know, it's like this trip ended up spending almost as much as I've been making so far, but that's because of expenses that I should not have had to occur, and because you incur the most expenses wherever you are, even if you're frugal, with food. You know, you have to eat. So, you know, if I were alone, I'd probably eat the Subway sandwich every day, you know, something like that. But, you know, that's not always possible. But, yeah, I mean, I don't live off the writing. It's impossible. But I can maintain without worrying about it.
Who do you write for?
I write for myself, whoever I happen to be at the moment. I said that a long time ago to a friend. But as far as the non-poetry stuff, I basically only write for one newspaper now. It's called the Brooklyn Rail. Because I got...
Okay, you write for a newspaper.
Yeah, I write one article a month for a newspaper. I hate doing it.
But it's not poetry.
No, that's not poetry.
Okay.
It's a fun article about music.
All right. But poetry, you write it for yourself.
Well, like a long time ago, I had a conversation with a friend of mine about who we write for, you know, and one of my answers to him in a poem I wrote for him is, I write for myself, whoever I happen to be at the moment. And then I think I said, and right now, I'm you. So the thing is, yeah, I write for myself, but I've always been very conscious of the fact, unlike other people I know who claim to have no egos and blah, 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 you know, I've always been aware, at least since I'm a teenager at some point, that I want people to read my poems. It was never my intention to read poems in public. And people used to say to me after a good reading, that was a great performance, and I would get very angry and say, I'm not a performer. I read my poetry. And if you want to see more of it, buy my book. It's meant to be read in a book. But that changed for various reasons. Due to circumstances I was in, situations I was in at readings, and I became more performative as a reader. I still don't like to be called a performance poet. That's not what I am. A performance poet usually never reads from a page. They're completely flamboyant for other reasons. They have a lot of acting qualities in them, which I think I've accidentally developed, but I have developed performative quality. In other words, I'm not an actor. I read the work, I give it what I hope it deserves, even if sometimes I read it too fast. Like I mentioned recently in another interview, and I've said to other people many times, when I read this thing by a poet who I love dearly and who is a friend, Ted Jones, he talked about lifting the word off the page. And that's kind of what it's about. It's like the page and the word, if we want to relate it to music, those are my instruments, just like the saxophone is someone else's instrument. So, you know, yeah, I mean... I write it for And now, of course, if I'm out there reading to 5 people or 25 people or whatever they are, you know, I'm doing it for them. And there have been a few cases, like I said, where I've consciously written it for them, knowing I'm going to read it, that I'm writing this piece to read it out loud. But it's not necessarily my favorite thing to do. It's like writing for this newspaper. I hate it. And I know I'm writing it for other people to read, and my brain gets into a gear, and it's a different kind of guy who's writing it than the guy who's writing a poem. But I now know, whether it's a small audience or whatever, what they're expecting out of me, which is a little bit of humor, a little bit of reality, and a little bit of intelligence that, you know, this is how I felt about these 3 concerts I just saw. And this is where they're similar, and this is where they're different. And but I don't like to do that because it makes me think too linearly. I don't like to think linearly. I don't mind when I write, it sounds sometimes like, oh, this is very linear, like he's very narrative. But it's very different than actually having to write prose. Poetry gives me a lot of freedom, whereas even if I have to sometimes go like this to get a word out or another sentence out, come on, you know. But with prose, I don't feel almost any freedom, especially if I have to put a period at the end of the sentence. With liner notes, it's a little different because most people, like Michelle from Rogarten, and most of the people I've written liner notes for, in the rare exception, they say, no, you have to be very normal, like if you're writing an article for a magazine. But most of them let me do what I want. So even if it's kind of linear, you know, I could break the sentence up where I want. I can use what you were talking about, the spaces, the this and that. And I can have more fun and make it a little more poetic. So I don't feel as constrained when I'm writing a liner note because I can kind of be more flexible within the thing between poetry and prose. But for me, the most important thing is, even if you're trapped, to try to have as much freedom as you can while you're doing it. And that's what my process has always been since I was a kid and discovered what I thought James Joyce was doing, which was stream of consciousness. And later I found it was probably more like what Kerouac was doing, this spontaneous prose idea, which, you know, translates into poetry, a spontaneous poetry, which means you just go. You just, like what Kerouac called it, blowing. You're just blowing like a horn. And, you know, when your solo's over, you hope you know when it's over. And, you know, whether you know or don't, if it's over naturally, it stops. And a lot of my poems, people probably think I work them to death because they seem like they have a beginning and a middle and an end, and most of them do, because I'm sadly a very linear thinker. I was thought to think that way, and it's very difficult for me to become as experimental as I want to. But almost every poem in that book, no matter how normal it sounds, they were all written spontaneously.
I'll play the blues as we did in the thing, and we'll see how it works out.
Well, a lot of people have asked me, why did I write that book or any book? All the stories I wrote were true, because I believed in what I saw. I was traveling west one time at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, and the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, a great image of God with forefinger pointed straight at me. Through halos and rolls and gold folds that were like the existence of a gleaming spear in his right hand, which saith, come on, boy, go thou across the ground. Go moan for man. Go moan. Go groan. Go groan alone. Go roll your bones alone. Go thou and be little beneath my sight. Go thou and be minute as seed in a pod. Go thou, die hence. And of this world report you well and truly.
So would you say you're a jazz poet?
No. I would say other people say I'm a jazz poet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other people say I'm a beat poet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, but I would have to say that one of the higher aesthetics in my work that's emerged and grown is a direct result of music, and particularly a result of jazz. I mean, I've written poems for other types of music, but nowhere near as voluminous as the ones for jazz. So I would say I'm a poet who writes through jazz, through music.
You said it, you're a poet.
Oh, shit, I'm sorry. Can I say something to my wife off camera?
Yeah, sure.
Am I okay? Am I doing okay? You don't know? You don't want to say anything? Come on, you could say something. No? Okay. Later she'll tell me how shitty I was, that's all. I don't know all these terms like that have been developed through academia and other things, but there's one term, I don't even know if it has to do with anything that's academic. It might have even developed through music, the idea of playing through something or writing through. And it's like I learned, one great thing I learned through a lot of the musicians who I admire is the term I talked about recently again, spontaneous composition, rather than just calling it improvisation, because we're all creating on the spot, and that's what makes it really important. And I think with the poetry, because it's obviously there, once it's, you know, in the book, it's in the book. And maybe if I want to change one of those poems, I could do it at some other time, but I can't change that book anymore. So that spontaneous composition, which came through a process of as much freedom as I could attain while writing it, listening to the music in most of these cases, you know, now it's a permanent record, just like...
Just like your record.
Yeah, just exactly. If you put on a record, it's exactly that. And, you know, the good thing is even though this is chronological and they all have an organic interweaving with each other, just like a record, you could change the track whenever you want. You don't have to read the book from beginning to end. In fact, almost every book I've ever done, they're all interconnected. All the poems are interconnected in every book I've ever done, whether it's this, the music, other music-related books, or a book about my being the I'm going to mess up the word in French, but the superintendent, the concierge of my building, you know, sweeping the floors and taking out the garbage. Now, that's a very special book. Some of the stuff was written at different times, but they're all connected to the fact that I was the guy who cleaned my building. And they're all interconnected, but, you know, if you say to me, do I have to read it from beginning to end like a novel? No, Raphael, open it any way you want. You can read any chapter, they're all independent.
So it is often said that that kind of music we're talking about, like that relies on spontaneous composition, and you said it earlier, like tension and concentration and then abandonness. That's mm-hmm. what you said. Mm-hmm. And all these people you're talking about, Roscoe Mitchell and Charles Gales and so on, it is often said that this particular way of doing music in jazz music is very political. How do you relate to that?
To be honest with you, Raphael, I'd rather really not answer that question, because that's really up to the individual musician to tell you if they're coming from a political place or not. I mean, you know, it's been common knowledge, particularly in America, say that, you know, African Americans created jazz, which is not a word they created, but that the music comes from deep political and racial sources, and you know, this is something that may not be for this conversation, because we can sit and talk about it for 2 or 3 hours and I have my own views on it. But it's a very individual thing. You know, I think...
So what's your thinking?
You mean in my work?
Yeah.
I always did not think of or want my work to be socially or politically involved. And then whether it's pieces I've written lately in the last 10 years to be read in public, because I was given a kind of theme, like the theme is peace or the theme is this, which now if I read those poems, I don't read this cutesy parts about love and this and that and the other stuff, but all my own work that I've written since I'm a kid, I always use an example of one I wrote when I was a really young teenager, you know, why are there so many whys? Now, that's very social and political. Why? Meaning, why are all these things always happening? Why are we always questioning everything? And sadly or happily, and sometimes I think it's sadly, whenever I read most of my work, they always say the same thing. Why is the world so fucked up? Why are people so fucked up? Why? So I guess my work, even if it's against my own will, is very social and political, yeah. But as far as the music goes, of course, I can name musicians who are very political and overtly so. They're socially and politically committed and they'll say it. There are other musicians or artists who I've talked to a lot who are very socially and politically committed, but they might say, no, it's not part of my vocabulary, my work. But it's also very difficult for it not to seep in. But if you listen to, you know, when Cecil Taylor plays, sure, but the origins of his music can come from as far back as, you know, Henry Cowell to more recent, like Ligeti, to every great pianist that ever lived, particularly African-American pianists, like, you know, Art Tatum, Bud Powell. You know, he's historically aware of everything. So it's part of his, with Roscoe, I don't want to even narrow it down to, well, it's all political and he's an African-American and this and that. Someone we know who just met Roscoe recently on the train, he said he wants to study Baroque music now. So is it political? I don't know.
Where does your family come from?
My parents were born in America,
yeah,
in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Their grandparents came from Belarus, which is that vague area called White Russia. So the whole Minsk and Pinsk kind of area where, you know, you didn't know whether you were Polish, whether you were Russian, you know, you did know one thing, they escaped from the shtetls and you knew they were Jewish, if nothing else. But I once asked my parents when I was very young, am I Polish or Russian? Are we Polish? Because there were a lot of, in America, bad Polish jokes. And they said, oh, don't worry, we're Russian. So I said, oh, okay, good. I'm very happy about that. So, basically my roots are Russian. And sometimes Yuko says she can feel that in me, although I don't know. Maybe it's because Russians are very oppressive and dark. And, and some of them, especially most of the ones that live in New York, are dumb. But, yeah. You know, and I like to use that term that people like to use now, like a, what is that term actually? You know, like a man of the world, like I'm everywhere, mm-hmm, and nowhere at the same time. But that's, mm-hmm, not true. I'm a New York boy. I'm a small town kid from Brooklyn, you know, and I'll always feel like a small town kid from Brooklyn. So,
Are you Jewish?
I am. Why? Are you you anti-Semitic? Yeah, I don't talk about it a lot. I don't talk about any ethnicity a lot. I don't like ethnicity. Ethnicity is one of the main causes for problems. Ethnicity and religion have caused more problems in the world.
Sure, I agree. Mm. Well, I find it interesting because Jewish happen to have a little in common with African Americans.
Well, people like to say that. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, and the first time I heard Go Down Moses, which mm-hmm. was, you know, an anthem of African Americans, I was, anthem, that's a terrible word to use. But, you know, I said, wow, you know, yeah, we're related. We've had a very similar struggle, but I don't really, that stuff is too complicated. And people really, really have abused each other's ethnicities and stereotypes. And I think it's a really major problem. The only reason I brought it up is because I'm always very vague about it. And I joke with a lot of people and tell them I'm Italian, that my origins are from Italy. And then every now and then someone would say to me, oh, you're Jewish? But I thought you were Italian. And I would say, yeah, Dolacinskiano, it's really an Italian name. But no, I mean, the thing is about being in Europe with a name like that, or in New York at this point in history, is, yeah, it could be a Russian name, it could be a Polish name, and, you know, it is. I mean, that's what it is. But I brought it up to you because I don't think just narrowly saying, yeah, my origins are Russian, and mostly when you tell people where, you know, Belarus and Minsk and Pinsk, anybody who studied a little bit of that, which I'm not a good at geography at all, that's usually what happens, because there was a huge migration of Jews from that area in the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century when my grandparents came here. But I usually don't like to talk about it because that opens up a whole different can of worms.
Yeah,
which
sure.
I don't mind talking about because I've never have talked about it. But it's very uncomfortable, and I don't want to relate them, you know, the oppression of the Jews to the oppression of African Americans, because, you know, there's a lot of also a real, real lot of tension between African Americans and Jews and people in general and Jews. You know, we just get the bad rap for everything. So we're responsible for everything bad that ever happened in the world. So, but if you want to ask me specific questions, I'll be glad to answer. But you see, you're making me blush.
But actually, I wanted to bring that up because I think that one of the best poems that are in the Charles Gayle's book is the one where you wrote down the speech he gave about sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Mm-hmm. I read that a lot last week in Germany because I told my German friend, translate whatever you want from the book, and I gave him specific poems, but I didn't give him that poem. He translated that on his own, so I read it about 5 times last week. And I also read it when I was in the biennial of Val d'Amont Poetry Festival. I was asked to read a poem by the river in Val d'Amont, and for some reason I picked that poem. Sometimes when I read it aloud now, I change it a little bit. So it's not so specifically Charles, and it's more specifically myself as well, or more general. Let's say I make it more general now, and I take some lines out about, like, if we made cars, they'd be different colors and all that, because I know what Charles meant by that. But if I could rewrite that poem now, I would. And I could read it to you exactly how I would rewrite it. But yeah, that's a very heavy, heavy poem.
But so do you feel sometimes as a Jewish, as a motherless child?
I feel, my feelings about so-called ethnicity and race are very, very complicated. And basically, you know, I could say it in one sentence and people would really hate me for it, but I would rather not be Jewish. But I would rather not be any religion, or race, or creed, or color, or ethnicity.
Can't you just quit?
Quit being ethnic?
Quit being Jewish?
Well, I don't... Well, you know, certain things you just can't quit, but, I mean, I'm not gonna convert to Catholicism. So, yeah, I just quit thinking about I would like to quit all I... You know, and there's a line in this book, which no one ever talks about, where I say I'm Jewish. And the thing about that line is... Well, everybody misses it, because there was one version of the poem where I took out that word. It's in a section in the book called Blue. And one of the lines in there is, I am poor, white, crippled American boy. But the original line is, I am poor, white, crippled Jewish American boy. And I think when I finally put the poem in the book, I said, just take off your clothes. I mean, don't deny yourself or anybody else the reality of your roots. I mean, because we all have roots, whether we like it or not. And so your question is, can I quit? Well, it's not about quitting. It's about how much you relate positively or negatively to what you are. I don't want to... I would rather not, because it's a very painful subject to me, I would rather not have to relate anyway to it, except that, oh, I really love good Eastern European / Jewish food the way I like good French food and good Chinese food and good Japanese food. And as far as the culture goes, I sadly have divorced myself from the culture. So a lot of it's inborn in me, but I don't know enough about my own... Like, I don't know... and, you know, you can edit this out, but when you interviewed Myra Melford and Ben Goldberg, I don't know if you talked to Ben Goldberg about being Jewish, but, you know, he's as Jewish as you get. And he had a very radical klezmer group for a long time. And, that's one of the things that was first and foremost in his music for a while. Now, I don't want Judaism or any ism to be first and foremost in my music. I mean, a lot of my poetry, in a weird sense, could be taken as even being very socialistic or communistic, which it probably has lots of hints of. But what it really is very democratic. Regardless of my negative attitude, it's very democratic.
Maybe as jazz is.
Yeah, jazz... I think one thing jazz strives for is democracy and equality. But we can also use those terms and go beyond the political or the social. Because democracy, in the biggest sense of the word, like many other terms that people developed, love, democracy, blah, blah, you know, they go beyond political boundaries. I think there's a great Jimmy Cliff song where he uses the term beyond boundaries, beyond the political boundaries. Because the political boundaries, whether you're a hip left winger or you're a conservative right winger, the problem is we can't stop them. That's the whole problem. But even if I believe in the left and not in the right, the problem is we're so fucked up because of that. Whether we're this or we're that. It's like a poem I wrote where I say, I don't want to be black, I don't want to be white, I don't want to be wrong, and I don't want to be right. And I was talking to, that to someone the other day, and who was biracial, and he said to me, oh, no, man, I don't mind being black. And I said, yeah, but that's not what I meant. I said, I just don't want, there's too much divisional boundaries and people keep making them. And, you know, the idea of making them out of language, which is what I use as my primary tool, is very bad. It just, so it's the same with
Yeah, but what you just said could be used to dismiss political fightings, you know? It's like when you're a feminist, people tell you, hey, stop dividing society between men and women.
Oh, you know, now you're going to get into a whole different thing. If if you're talking about advancements that people should make as far as whether it's, you know, feminism or racism well, of course, we wouldn't have made any advancements without people starting actions to create better lives and more equality in the world. See, I'm probably the wrong person to speak to about this because I'm not that kind of political thinker where I can tell you. I'm a stupid, naive person who thinks that it's a real shame that everybody is so fucked up and treats each other so badly.
Yeah, but would you want to erase differences?
Would I want to do what?
Erase differences.
Erase them?
Yeah.
You mean, do I want everybody to be equal?
Yeah. No, the same.
You know, someone else once said this to me. In fact, the person who lives here, Michelle Daubon, once said to me, do you want everybody to be the same? And you're talking about, do I want your creative ability and your output to look exactly like my output? No, that's not what I mean. I'm not talking about a totalitarian government. I'm talking about very stupid, simple, utopian ideas of which I say over and over again is put forth by Rodney King. Why can't we all just get along? And everybody, because of a weird political systems, whether they're, and at this point in history, and I mean this seriously, and no offense to anybody, but whether they're male or female, it's all about macho dominance. And it's particularly still most and foremost in males, you know, whether it's Putin or Winton, you know, there's an intolerable dominance. And, you know, the difference between Winton and Putin is Winton tries to restrict a musical flow and put it in a box, and like certain, you know, post-bop musicians and bop musicians who think anything after Charlie Parker isn't worth, you know, listening to, or classical music listeners who think, or composers who think anything after Beethoven, you know, should be thrown in the garbage. So, you know, it's the same with all those extremes, except in the political world, when you deal with Putin, you know, he's dangerous. They're all dangerous. But if someone's trying to restrict music or forget the history of where music went, that's very dangerous. But when one human being, whether it's Adolf Hitler or Putin or Stalin or a lot of people we can name, you know, Khmer Rouge, so many people, when they try to completely stop the world and stop you from thinking at all, like when we just came from Berlin and, you know, Berlin is overwhelming with horrid history. And one of the things that got me the most wasn't just looking at the Reichstag where they planned everybody's death, but seeing the Berlin Wall, which by that time, that's petty. That's beyond megalomaniacal insanity. That's a bunch of idiot assholes being so petty that they did so much damage after all that damage was already done. They just continued to perpetuate the damage in the most petty way with a wall that when I saw wasn't any higher from the floor to the ceiling, I'm thinking, God, how petty. And that almost made me cry more than the Holocaust, because it was a petty continuation of horror. And that, you know, that cliched statement of man's inhumanity to man. So the thing is, I always apologize for not being an activist, but also I'm just so tired of, man's, not just their inhumanity to man, but their idiocy. Like, you know, if they want to do something really idiotic, let them all take one, you know, we are the world, we are the people, you know, let them take, like, you know, Yuko got really, really incensed when she saw people taking a selfie in front of what's left of the Berlin Wall. You know, I walked out of my house right after 9/11, and I walked to my corner where I could see the towers fall down. And the first thing I saw people do the second time I walked out were, and it was a couple of ethnicity, but I'm not going to blame it on their ethnicity, and I won't say what their ethnicity was, but, you know, you could see the towers right down the street falling and burning, and they took a photo of themselves. This is before the word selfie. But, you know, I mean, that's how inane people are. So I don't want to get into controversies about, you know, Jews and blacks. And I mean, I know in my personal feelings what are causing problems in the world. And, you know, and a lot of it has to do with sick macho extremism. So to me, any extremism is bad. I mean, if you're talking about things that have really helped people progress out of the dark ages, anything to certain points of work. Sure, feminism is a very important movement, and it worked. And, you know, integration was very important, although even a lot of my African-American friends still have problems with what integration positively helped, but on some levels destroyed, like, you know, certain family fabric in the South. It's very difficult. That's why I don't like to talk about it, because I don't think I'm qualified to talk about it. I just want everybody to get along. And if I want to jump around and curse and have fun, then that's what I want to learn to do as I get older, you know? So can we strike all that out of the conversation?
We'll see.
I'm sorry I brought that ethnic word up. I should have not, because I didn't expect the conversation to go there.
So, my last question would
That's
be...
That's it, the last question already?
Yeah.
God.
Would be, so you've been to pretty much each and every concert in New York for the last, like, 30 years. So tell me, how bad is jazz doing right now?
Wait, I've been listening... Wait, say the question again. Well, first of all, I was born in New York, so I've spent most of my life there, and I guess... I started listening to jazz. Good sound, actually. I started listening to jazz 55 years ago or something like that. You're gonna hate me for saying this, Raphael, but and I'm still very sorry we got off on that other thing, because it really took us away from whatever we were talking about. But I don't think I'm qualified to say what the state of jazz in New York is. You know, everybody has their different opinion. You know, New York has become radically gentrified since the 80s, but New York has become radically gentrified since the 1890s. New York is always being radically gentrified and then demoralized, and new ghettos rise up, and then more people come in and gentrify, and it always starts accidentally with artists moving into a neighborhood, and then the galleries move in, and then the boutiques move in, and then the places that, it's like the poem I wrote with the lattes and the cappuccinos and the Gucci shoes, and if you look at the Charles Gayle book, like I think I mentioned to you, almost every venue in that book has disappeared, and most of them were very small venues. Everybody has a different opinion of how vital the small venues were, and I guess, of course, they were vital because they had this mom-and-pop quality, and every day, just like I'm sure in Paris on some levels, you know, a cafe disappears, a bookstore disappears, some hold on. Most of them, many of them moved to Brooklyn, and even some of them are disappearing in a short time because, you know, the rents are kind of crazy. I think the state of music was, you know, if we're just talking about jazz, was probably at its super height, you know, during the 1920s, then rose up again with swing, then had a completely different breath of life with, you know, with the bebop, and then came back up again with avant-garde jazz, a lot of whose center was in New York. Then maybe in the 70s, completely dropped dead. Then in the 80s, there was a fairly good firmament we caught, like Charles William Parker, that whole so-called Lower East Side improvising jazz scene, alongside that, you know, the other improvising jazz scene that, you know, Zorn and a bunch of people created. So, you know, it was more fertile than even I thought it was in the 80s. Then in the 90s, it went into a decline again. And I think in the thousands, you know, the Arts for Arts Vision Festival people, you know, try to keep it alive and really help maintain it. And there are a lot of young kids who open venues in Brooklyn and they try to maintain it. Whether it's in a, like a lot of people think it's in a very sad state or a sick state. And I think it really depends on your point of view. It's like, you know, people say there are small audiences, there's not enough. To be honest with you, there were almost always small audiences. If it was, I mean, where I went, unless you went to the Village Vanguard or, you know, the bigger clubs. And when I was younger and went to like an Archie Shepp concert in Town Hall in the 60s, it was full of people. I think if we went to an Archie Shepp concert now in Town Hall, it would be full of people. So it's a matter of how you're digesting all the shit that's happened and how you spit it back out. So I think everything's in trouble. But I think sometimes we exaggerate the trouble. Some of the trouble we cannot fix because it's only going to get worse. And as far as the music, it's alive. So it hasn't died. And, you know, whether I go to hear music I like or I'm not that crazy about, whether it's in Paris or in New York, I can still go out every night and hear music. And there are a few venues who are still very strong on trying to give us as good quality music as we can get. I mean, yeah, if we look at the biggest problem of what's happened to New York since 2001, to the greatest extent ever in my life, as someone who was born there, is it's like a metaphor I used to Yuko a long time ago when we saw Escape from New York, the film Escape from New York. I said, in the future, the escape from New York will be that New York will be pretty much primarily for the very rich. And, you know, that's what it is. So the problem with a certain kind of money coming into a city that's full of culture is they also start buying the culture and manipulating the culture and or presenting a different kind of culture that suits the museum or suits, you know, whatever it is they're trying to suit. And that doesn't mean it's all ingenuous, but the thing is, with jazz itself and the jazz that that we've been narrowed down to loving the most, which is so-called free jazz, avant-garde jazz, or whatever you want to call it, it still suffers the most. When a great great improvising jazz musician can't always fill a room that holds 30 to 50 people, that's sad. When I found out that someone like Bar Phillips, who's very sick and may not be part of the tour they were supposed to make, when I saw Jacques Demiel 2 weeks ago in a gig in Paris, if Bar felt better and he did do the gig, I know the venues that they're going to play in New York if they haven't already played. And Bar Phillips shouldn't be playing in a venue that holds 15 or 20 people. He's Bar Phillips, you know. He's got a real history. So on that level, you know, it's problematic. But then at the same time, the Vision Festival every year has pretty much gotten stronger and stronger. And, like, you know, the past few years, almost every concert has been filled near capacity. Now, I can't talk about whether they're breaking even, making money. That's a whole other issue, the financial end of it. But there's enough people who, since it started, who've been coming from all over. So there's a certain health that's being maintained. But can it be healthier? Can it be stronger? Anything that's good should be stronger. But we always still have to watch out for isms and how far those isms go, you know. And you know, there's a certain kind of democracy that we always have to remember, and anything has to be maintained. And it's not that easy to do, because these words are words that have become more concepts than meanings. Like capitalism, no problem there. It's become a reality. It is a reality. It's very fundamental. It says something, it does something, it means something, and it causes a lot of some things, bad things mostly. But it also keeps a lot of little people alive. It's a toss-up. I strike it off from the record.
I thought this was
going to be more fun, that we were going to have more fun. See, it's all these lights and stuff. So, what do you say?
We can't tell.
You can't tell anything. You can chop it up a lot. You know? But, I didn't expect us to get into political and ethnic stuff. I don't like talking about that stuff too much.
Okay.
But, I mean, if it works for you, that's okay.
It's fine.
It's okay?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, from the top of the whirling restaurant of the world, you have seen Raphael and Steve talk about space. Thank you.